Thanks for joining us for the Iowa Art Showcase. This is Iowa Public Radio's monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. Today, we're celebrating June events on the Iowa Art Showcase. We'll learn how Juilliard in June has morphed into a new Dubuque festival. We'll hear about the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's outdoor performances of the Mikado. We'll catch up on the musical philosophy behind the Five Seasons Chamber Music Festival. And we'll glimpse into the creative world of an unlikely pair of collaborators, a nun and a composer, as they grapple with a 21st century operatic adaptation of Sister Helen Prejean's book, Dead Man Walking. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
You don't know what it's like to see your child go out of the door and your last words are clean your room, do your homework, and then he's gone, and then he's gone.
Author and humanitarian Sister Helen Prejean, singing a part performed by one of the victims' mothers from Jake Hagee's opera, based on Sister Helen's 1993 nonfiction book, Dead Man Walking. Sister Helen was in Iowa recently speaking about her experiences as a spiritual advisor to Angola prison death row inmates. She also spoke about Jake Hagee's 21st century adaptation of her book. Along with their production this summer, the Des Moines Metro Opera brought Sister Helen to Iowa and will bring composer Jake Hagee to the state later this month. Through their Staging Connections program, the DMMO has also collaborated with Drake and Grandview Universities to give Iowans a chance to immerse themselves in the social and legal issues raised in Sister Helen's book. Librettist Terrence McNally and composer Jake Hagee set Dead Man Walking into an opera in 2000. Since its premiere, the opera has been presented in over 50 different productions. Later this hour, we'll speak with Jake Hagee about the opera. Sister Helen continues talking about another mother in this opera, a mother who is also about to lose her son.
We have all suffered enough. The mother of Joseph DeRochet has a prominent part in this story because we're looking at the victims' families and what they've suffered. Their children have been murdered. But now this mother comes on the fore and she goes, haven't we all suffered enough? Haven't we? Haven't we? You don't know. You don't know what it's like. You don't know. They're all singing, and I'm caught in a crossfire of it, mainly just saying, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And then the genius of this story is that Terrence McNally realizes there's another mother in the story, and it's the mother of Joseph DeRochet, the man who did the killing, a woman who has never appeared in public, has never spoken over a microphone, has to try to find the words to say to the pardon board, don't kill my Joe. Don't kill my son. And she's singing, you don't know what it's like to see your child slip through your hands. You don't know what it's like. And when Jake Hagee hit this, when he composed this, when he came to this, he called me. He was very excited. He said, Helen, I think we have the heart of the opera. They're all singing, and they're all singing the same pain. You don't know what it's like. And he's right. He did come to the heart of the opera in this. And that's what art is about, to bring us into the heart of things in a way. And the beauty of the opera is because you have the live drama happening there and the music, the resonance of the music that is bringing us to places of our heart. And music has a way of bringing us to places in our heart we don't even know we have. And it's done masterfully. I couldn't ask for it to be done better than it's being done. I've come to appreciate it from a whole other perspective now, going through this experience of of Dead Man Walking becoming the opera. And I've experienced the opera in Dresden, Germany, and San Francisco when it premiered. And the music's inside me now. It's haunting, and it stays inside you.
Sister Helen grew up in a loving Catholic home. Her dad was a lawyer, and her mama was a nurse. She had a brother and a sister, and they all prayed the rosary together. She attended St. Joseph's All-Girl Academy in Baton Rouge and took her vows at the age of 18.
I'm still grateful that I woke up. Enlightenment is not ever anything that we can claim for ourselves or make happen. We can get educated on something, but to wake up, and that I woke up to the deeper dimensions about human rights and in my own faith. Of course, I never dreamed it would come to this. And in fact, every time I drive to our prison at Angola, right across the highway where you turn off to go to Angola, on the other side is Camp Marydale. It's a Girl Scout camp. It's where between 5th and 6th grade I went to Girl Scout camp. And we would be these young giggling girls in the cabin at night when it got dark. And people would start with, you know, those convicts in Angola. Right down at the other end of this road here, and they could get out, and they could come to our cabin, and those convicts just as soon kill you as look at you, and everybody's squealing and huddling together in the cabin. The criminals, the convicts, they're all over there at Angola. And I never dreamed of how I'd be going down that Angola road, that I would be accompanying 6 people to their deaths, continuing to accompany people on death row. I had no idea how my life was going to turn out or what it would bring me to.
Sister Helen reflects on witnessing her first death row execution and how Jake Hagee's opera brought this experience into focus.
And when I came out of the killing chamber that night, 1984, I remember thinking, we got to find a way to bring people close to this. And there's no closer way of coming to an execution than having it right there before you. And Jake Hagee, the composer, as the execution is happening, all we hear is the sound of the machines. It's the only opera with 1.5 minutes of silence. So we have to attend. Okay, the act of justice is now happening, and the man who did that terrible murder that we witnessed in the beginning is now getting justice. And we're brought close to it. And that's what the arts do for us. They open us up and bring us close to things in a way we wouldn't otherwise have a way of going. God will gather us around, all around. God will gather us around. Father, mother, sisters, brothers, gather us, and the last sound of the opera is her voice, a cappella, round.
Sister Helen Prejean, author of Dead Man Walking, came to Iowa last month. She was part of the Des Moines Metro Opera Staging Connections, encouraging community involvement in this summer's DMMO productions of Jake Hagee and Terrence McNally's opera, Dead Man Walking. The Des Moines Metro Opera will present performances of Dead Man Walking at the Blank Performing Arts Center in Indianola. This work is not recommended for anyone under 18 years of age. For more information about all the operas and extra activities presented this summer in the Des Moines Metro Opera's 42nd festival season, please see their website at desmoinesmetroopera.org. If Iowa Public Radio's arts programming and the Iowa Arts Showcase is important to you, please support it by making your tax-deductible pledge of support today at iowapublicradio.org, and thanks. Just ahead, details about the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's Mikado performances, the Five Seasons Chamber Festival, Jake Hagee on his opera Dead Man Walking, and Chamberfest Dubuque. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase. It's the Iowa Art Showcase, I'm Jacqueline Hoblin.
I'm Karen Impala. Each week at this time, we feature concerts and recitals recorded
bringing the cultural
Iowa.
Richness of our state to your radio, Iowa Public Radio Classical.
This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. Tonight is the Midwest International Piano Competition Senior Finals, starting at 5 p.m. Three pianists will vie for the $10,000 cash prize, recording and management contracts, and a solo performance with the WCF Symphony. Tickets are available at the door of UNI's Gallagher Bluedorn Performing Arts Center. If you're unable to attend in person, please join Iowa Public Radio Classical for our live Performance Iowa broadcast featuring these three world-class young pianists performing their hearts out. Dubuque native Juilliard grad composer and Chamberfest Dubuque artistic director Michael Gilbertson will return to the state for this year's Chamberfest to benefit the Northeast Iowa School of Music. This year's festival includes a Juilliard Orchestra concert and friends, a Chamberfest Gala concert, formerly known as Juilliard in June, and a Chamberfest workshop. Michael shares a few details about how the Juilliard in June festival originally got its start.
Back in 2009, when the economy was really doing badly, the Northeast Iowa School of Music was struggling, like a lot of performing arts organizations, and to help them out and to help raise money for them, I started a new music festival here called Juilliard in June. And I was still a student at Juilliard at the time, and I brought out some of my best friends, and we did a concert here in Dubuque to raise money for NYSOM. And it's become, I think, their most successful fundraiser they've ever had. We've continued it every summer for them, and over the years we've added some educational opportunities and a program we call Chamberfest Dubuque, which this past year involved a lot of community musicians and student musicians, and we did a side-by-side concert with our guest artists and with the student musicians, which was really exciting for us. So it's a chamber music festival, which has always brought, you know, a violinist, a cellist, Dubuque's own Bridget Pasker, who's a great, great cellist, also a graduate of Juilliard now, and we always bring a great concert pianist. One year we had a dancer from Juilliard, Kate Hurstein-Mayevsky, who is a choreographer and dancer, and she did some dance work with us, and this past year we had a vocalist for the first time, a mezzo-soprano named Virginia Warnkin, who is one of the most versatile artists we've ever had. She sang Cole Porter and Journey and Bizet's Carmen and some Brahms songs and some Purcell. The music she sang spanned four centuries, and it was just amazing to have her here with us. We were so lucky to have her this past summer.
Dubuque native, Juilliard grad, composer, and Chamberfest Dubuque artistic director Michael Gilbertson talking about Chamberfest Dubuque. This year's festival will be held between June 16th and 19th. For locations and details, please see the Northeast Iowa School of Music website at nisom.com. Another exciting workshop being held during the last week of June at Iowa State University is the Heartland Marimba Festival. The event concludes with a rollicking Banshell Park concert on June 28th. For more details, please check out hearmatthewcauley.com/Heartland Marimba. If you enjoy hearing about the performing arts scene on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase and the role Iowa Public Radio plays in presenting behind-the-scenes arts info about the arts, please make your pledge of support today at iowapublicradio.org, and thanks. This is the Iowa Art Showcase.
I think the community is ready again for operetta out under the stars at Brusmore. So we're really hoping to continue that next summer, offering The Man of La Mancha. You know, that's another wonderful piece with great tunes, great music, great story. And, you know, Man of La Mancha hasn't been done, in, to my knowledge, in this area, well, since I can remember. So I think it's going to be a wonderful sort of renewal of our time at Brusmore.
The Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's founder and music director, Dr. Daniel Kleinkonect, talking about the revival of their young artist summer performance tradition on the lawn of Brusmore. This summer, the CROT will be presenting the Mikado, and next summer, the Man of La Mancha. Daniel fills us in on the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's new season ahead.
Well, it's going to be an exciting season. We start in September 18th. We're having a little opening at the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art from 5:30 to 7:30. And we'll do a couple of excerpts from the main productions that we're doing next season, that being Don Giovanni and Man of La Mancha. So we have Don Giovanni, I think it's January 16 and 18, 2015 at the Paramount. And in tandem with that, we'll be again giving our young artist outreach opera, Billy Goat's Gruff. We'll be taking that into the community schools. Then in April, we will have our every other year opera gala. And this is going to be at the Cedar Rapids Country Club. Can't come up with the date just now, but it's mid to late April. And then Man of La Mancha at Bruce Moore again. And next year we're going to be doing four performances at Bruce Moore in approximately the same part of June, like the third week of June, 2015. So it's a season we really look forward to, and we hope our listeners will be interested in hearing two pieces that we haven't done. We've never done Don Giovanni, and we've never done Man of La Mancha. So I think those will be really interesting offerings for Cedar Rapids Opera Theater.
Daniel continues talking about the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's Young Artist Program and their extensive selection process.
One wonderful thing about our Young Artist Program is that I think we are really able to get the best of the best of the young singers here in the Midwest. In the fall, I take an audition trip throughout Iowa. I go to Luther, University of Northern Iowa, the University of Iowa, Davenport, the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and Roosevelt in Chicago. And I think I heard over 110 singers this fall. And these, I think, are really high-achieving singer-actors. We have a singer from Colorado, several singers from Iowa, Illinois, and I think we have one singer from Indiana, if I'm not mistaken. So it's going to be a wonderful young cast of singers, some of whom were understudies in our production of Carmen, and all of them were in our opera chorus of Carmen, and a few of them were in our production of Billy Goat's Gruff, which was our touring piece in January.
He continues with how the June 19th through 21st Gilbert and Sullivan Mikado performances fit into their season.
It's really the end of our season, and we're, yes, going back outside to Bruce Moore. We haven't been there since 2008. I think that was a production of HMS Pinafore, another Gilbert and Sullivan favorite. So we are really looking forward to bring our production outside.
Well, tell us a bit about who the music director and the stage director is going to be.
Well, it's interesting. We're bringing back our favorite Dr. John Hollins. John has conducted many things for our summer productions like Into the Woods and HMS Pinafore, Pirates of Penzance, and I think he conducted the first time we did Mikado in 2005. He's a brilliant pianist, a brilliant conductor, so we welcome him back. And he is a faculty member at Texas Tech University in Lubbock. And the singers always love working with John. He's a great coach, great conductor, and quite a fine gentleman to work with. And we're pairing him with Brian Ludloff. Brian is our stage director, and it's the first time Brian is going to be coming here to Cedar Rapids, so I'm really looking forward to welcoming him into our opera family. He's an academic, and I guess I would say he's an outside of academia professional as well. He's a professor of music at the University of Northern Colorado in Greeley, and he's artistic director of Opera Fort Collins. So I think he's going to bring an interesting perspective to our community. And I like the idea of bringing someone in who presides over a company approximately the same size as our community, like Cedar Rapids. So it will be interesting to see what he has to say about bringing opera to regional opera companies. And he's going to be a great stage director.
Well, tell us a little bit about Gilbert and Sullivan, because they really had a terrific partnership going.
A terrific partnership. What a great blending of, I guess I would say, scintillating words and images. and matched by tuneful melodies and really a style that is, I think, perfect for our outdoor audiences at Bruce Moore, you know, things that are light and colorful. And what I'm thinking about is sort of the beauty of the visual element, the beautiful sky, the beautiful trees there at Bruce Moore, and blended with the kimonos of the ladies. And interesting, I think, will be Brian's perspective. He's setting this production in 1950s occupied Japan. So I think we're going to see a little bit of blending of mid-century costumes and then traditional beautiful Japanese warriors and traditional kimonos. It will really nicely match the light character of the music and the bubbly images of the words. I think it'll be a great evening and three great performances.
Daniel talks about one of Gilbert and Sullivan's big Mikado hits.
Three Little Maids from School is really one of the highlights of the piece. And in fact, when I talk to my mother, who is 96 years old, she'll start humming the song. She'll start remembering this because it was a piece that she sang when she was in middle school or high school. And it's a funny piece. It's not quite a patter song, but it does have that bubbly nature of a lot of words and three little schoolgirls in their beautiful kimono.
Daniel shares how to get tickets to this operetta full of amusing disguises, executioners, long-lost loves, and delightful music.
Well, we do have the advantage of offering tickets in advance or at the door, so either way works. Advance ticket sales or student tickets are $15. Advance tickets for non-Bruce Moore members are $18. And all tickets at the gate are $20. And we are an affiliated event with the Freedom Festival. So people who have a Freedom Festival button, I think, get a bit of a discount. It might be $2 discount, but people can buy tickets at the door or in advance. It works either way.
The Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's founder and music director, Dr. Daniel Kleinkenecht, outlining ways to get tickets to their June 19th through 21st young artist performances of the Mikado on the lawn at Bruce Moore in Cedar Rapids. Tickets are available at 319-362-7375 and online at brucemoore.org. Remember to bring a picnic, beverages, and lawn chairs or blankets. Bruce Moore gates open at 6:30 for their 7:30 performances. Salisbury House in Des Moines is presenting their Shakespeare on the Lawn June 12th through the 15th. For details and tickets, please see salisburyhouse.org. Just ahead, we'll find out about Jake Hagee's appearance at the Des Moines Metro Opera's opening night performance of Dead Man Walking. And we'll get the inside scoop on why the Five Seasons Chamber Music Festival is so unique. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
One of the things that has impressed me about Five Seasons is it's got a strong family feeling to it. And of course, part of that is because there are several members of one family that are involved in running it. That's Stephanie's family. You know, I think between the musicians, some of whom grew up playing together or spent time at college or conservatory together and developed that sense of connection and family. And then, you know, others of us who have, you know, joined in a little bit later on, but have been attracted to the festival because of that quality. I think there's a shared sense of a family-type environment at the festival, which is one of the things that draws me back to it, and I think has drawn students to it and faculty to it. That's different than maybe what you might experience at some other festivals, and I think that's kind of a special thing. For many of us as professional musicians, that in itself is a bit of a nice antidote to perhaps our year-round routine. And I think in a way, there's nothing better you could ask for out of a summer festival than to have an antidote to what you do every day and to come out of it feeling, you know, refreshed and re-energized. And that's how I feel about Five Seasons.
It's an intensive week for the students. They spend more hours with their instruments, but it's also a fun week. We work very hard to make sure that we all have fun together. And we've had many students who have come out of this program who have said they enjoy this festival more than some of the more prestigious ones. The idea behind bringing people into Cedar Rapids is that they could go to the Interlakens, they could go to the Eastern, they could go to the Madeline Islands. Some folks don't have time, some folks don't have money, and so this program offers them something local, and it offers them something special.
Artistic director Stephanie Wager, along with conductor and chamber music coach Jason Weinberger, talking about why the Five Seasons Chamber Music Festival is so exceptional. This year marks the festival's 12th season, and it still isn't too late to sign up to participate. As Stephanie says, this wasn't her kids' typical request to drive them to softball practice, but before it was over, she did end up stepping up to the plate.
It's a program that was founded by Suzanne and Rich Wager, my children, and Timothy Hsu, violin, originally from the Maya Quartet. They decided that this is a program they wished had been in place in Cedar Rapids when they were growing up here. So they started the program with a quartet plus bass as faculty and a conductor. And Jason was our first conductor.
How did you become the festival artistic director, Stephanie?
My children said, you would like to help us with that, wouldn't you, Mom?
And that's how you got hooked, or you started doing it and you loved it so much?
I said, I can do that. And it's gone from there. I just keep doing it.
Well, tell us about some of the things about it. And one of the things is that when did you get this residency at Mount Mercy University? How did it get started?
A few years ago, Dr. Gerald Kreitzer was invited there to do things that brought the community in and brought in the fine arts more than had happened in previous years. And he had been at Washington High School when my children were there, and he knew we did this program. And so he said to Rich, what would it take to get the Five Seasons Festival in residency here? He'd always wanted to have a chamber music program in residency. And we were looking for a place that could accommodate our large orchestra. So this was a central community location. And we have been there now. This will be our second year. And the chapel houses our orchestra well, because our orchestra will have somewhere between 85 and 105 people in it. That's hard to fit on a small stage.
Let's talk about the participants and why you have selected students of all ages.
The program started with students of all ages because we wanted the camaraderie between them. And once we found a conductor who also believed in the camaraderie of students of all ages, which was Jason, then it was easy to go with that. I don't know where you got your appreciation of students of all ages.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up. That was my experience when I was a student at one of my favorite places, which is the Apple Hill Music Festival. And that's a place where you play chamber music with other musicians from all ages and walks of life. And it had a huge influence on me as a young person. So I think Stephanie and I were somewhat united in the idea behind that, as well as some of the other people who have been involved in this festival. And in particular, when it comes to an orchestra, it's especially fun, and there's particular kinds of challenges that you deal with there. I mean, of course, in chamber music, kind of it's up to the players and maybe the coach to get it worked out as they rehearse. In an orchestra, you typically don't have quite as much time to get to know your partners, and you've got to be able to absorb the music more quickly. So this is interesting. I mean, there are times when the youngest musicians are challenged a little bit more. There are also folks, adults, who haven't played instruments in years, maybe. They're coming back, and they're kind of remembering how to do things, but also catching up at the same time. And then you have some very, very experienced musicians, and everybody's playing side by side. And that really is one of the exciting things about doing the orchestra program with students of all ages. And I really like that, the ambiance and the learning experience and the performance experience that it creates.
We try to have faculty at the front of the section and then faculty that run around the back of the orchestra to help people who are maybe need a bowing or maybe need, you know, somebody to show them where they are in the music.
So what are some of the chamber music ensembles that you're going to be having for your festival?
We'll have the traditional string quartets and other string ensembles. Then we have flute and harp ensembles, duos and choirs. We'll have piano quartets. We'll have a brass program, which will be a brass choir plus some smaller brass ensembles, and some woodwinds. And we're still working on how we mix those people all together.
And you're also going to have an orchestra. So why have an orchestra at a festival?
In this case, you know, I think there are a couple of reasons. One is, and Stephanie alluded to this, it really is kind of special when you're working with, let's say, a professional musician as your chamber music coach, to then have an opportunity to sit with them and play together. There's something really special about this experience with all of our coaches and mentors and other musicians who participate who have a great deal of experience. And then you have kids who are just, for the first time even, maybe playing in orchestra, or certainly playing in like a mixed ensemble outside of Suzuki or school or something like that. So that coming together of everybody who's working on their own piece of the week to do something common, that's really nice. It helps unify the group. And one of the other interesting things that happens at this great festival, there are other activities that bring the whole group together as well. So while there's a risk sometimes of being kind of siloed off into your own room while you work on the chamber music, it's nice to have those times when we all come together. The orchestra represents a smaller portion in terms of time, but it's a big part of the presentation overall.
We start each day together with maybe singing announcements, movement activities, get everybody awake and going. A little solfege has been thrown in there for the past few years. And then everyone's together for lunchtime and then orchestra time. Right before orchestra, of course, is the important time of the day. It's called snack time.
So what pieces are the orchestra going to be performing, Jason?
Well, you know, over the years, we've done some really interesting stuff. One of the neat features of this festival is the fact that we often have a soloist identified, and that can be a soloist who is one of the mentors or teachers at the festival. It can be a guest artist. So this is kind of, it's exciting from year to year. But this year we're going to mix that in. We're going to do a concerto, a Telemann concerto. And we're also going to use all of the strings in a work by Brooke Joyce, who's an Iowa composer, and WCS Symphony audiences are familiar with his work, and his music has actually been performed quite a bit around the state. He has a really fun, very effect-filled, but very fun piece for strings called Bat Out of Hell, which we're going to perform. And then we're going to do the opening movement of Schubert Unfinished Symphony. And that's a piece that's really wonderful for a group of this nature. It does, as Stephanie mentioned, it does allow us to mix in quite a diverse array of instruments. It's one of the earlier pieces that has, you know, kind of a full brass complement. And so we're excited to do these works together. And, you know, I think part of the idea is also to make sure that we cover some different styles and that all the participants have a chance to feel comfortable playing some of the music, but also to be challenged at the same time. So very excited about this year's repertoire.
We do really appreciate having the new sounds, the old sounds, the traditional orchestra sounds. Students don't get much of a chance unless they're able to be in a really well-organized youth orchestra or one that consistently plays. So even though they're not going to get to play a whole orchestral work, they get to work on something that's a traditional sound that goes along. But we also like them to have something different in their ears, something they have to really read. And this way, they don't know what's coming up next.
And I would also add to Stephanie's comments that there's something about rehearsing together every day of a full week, and that goes for chamber music and for orchestra music, which is a little bit different than what most of these participants are doing in their regular groups. But most youth orchestras and chamber music groups, if they're rehearsing and getting coached, are certainly not playing together day after day, several hours a day for 5 or 6 days at a time. And that gives some unique opportunities to choose repertoire both in chamber music and in orchestra. I think that otherwise might not want to choose if you're going to have a week between every rehearsal. It tends to be a much higher level of retention, and that's one of the reasons I think we've been able to perform some music that a casual observer might say, well, I'm not sure this is the right mix for this orchestra, but our sense has always been just how much can we challenge the group, and I think we've been successful so far in finding that balance.
Jason told me a few years ago what his goal for each day was, because I asked him how he could be pleasant and educational and articulate with this group of students and be happy with the results. And he told me that his goal is to get better every single day and that our orchestra always does that. So he meets his goal.
Well, tell us about the faculty and where these folks are from, Stephanie.
We've had them from all over the world. We've had from Spain and the Czech Republic and UK. This year, we happen to have a lot of people from New York City, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Illinois. It's wherever we happen to find these folks, and they like to come here. And we have people from the Midwest, from different colleges and universities and orchestras. I don't mean to leave them out at all.
Yeah, there's always been a nice Iowa contingent, including members of Stephanie's family, who have been not only part of this festival, but people that I've worked with outside of the festival. And then, of course, the relationships between the faculty are something that's also unique. We tend to usually get along pretty well. And some of these people actually work together quite a bit on a regular basis. So it's an interesting dynamic when we're together during the festival.
So, Jason, why is it important to have musicians and performers who are actively performing?
Oh, well, I think that's, in my experience, been one of the most valuable parts of kind of transmitting knowledge about what we do as performing artists. There's something very unique, very special about bringing a musical artwork to life that is quite a bit different from almost anything else you'll do, not just in the arts, but anywhere. It's very singular. It's a very unique experience. And in the case of Five Seasons Festival, all the participants in the festival have a chance to perform alongside the faculty, as well as to hear the faculty perform in various guises, whether as soloists or chamber musicians. And so there's a real level of aspiration that I think is set by that for the students who may not see that on an everyday basis. And this, in a lot of cases, I find this really opens eyes. I know for me as a student, this kind of thing made me reach out and reach further and go further. And I think that's the premise here as well. It really is an amazing horizon widening kind of experience as a student when you have a chance to work with teachers and faculty, mentors, even the people that you're sitting next to in orchestra. And they've done this quite a bit and have a lot of experience. And it's fun for me at Five Seasons to just see this going on. I love observing that transfer of knowledge and passion. So to me, that's a big piece of what goes on at Five Seasons every year.
One of our special things this year is that Bill Prusel Sr. is going to play the Telemann Concerto for Two Violas with Suzanne Wager. They performed that on her senior recital when she was graduating from Washington High School. So this is a special time for them.
Artistic director Stephanie Wager, along with conductor and chamber music coach Jason Weinberger, talking about this year's Five Seasons Chamber Music Festival, being held June 16th through the 21st on the Mount Mercy University campus in Cedar Rapids. They will present 3 days of festival concerts. On June 20th, the program will feature the flutes and harps at 5 and everyone else at 7 p.m. On the 21st, the festival faculty and the festival orchestra will perform at 7 p.m. Both of those concerts will be held at the Mount Mercy University Chapel. On June 22nd, they will travel to Terrell Park in Manchester, Iowa for their final program. All of these concerts are free and open to the public. To get more details about the Five Seasons Chamber Music Festival, please see their website at fiveseasonschambermusic.com. On June 21st, the St. Wenceslas Church in Spillville will be the site for a special 4 p.m. presentation of Dvorak, his music and his life in pictures, followed at 5 by the Chicago Piano Trio performing Dvorak's Piano Trio No. 3 in F minor, Opus 65. Don't go away. Composer Jake Hagee talks about his first opera, Dead Man Walking. You're listening to the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. Welcome to Iowa Public Radio's Performance Iowa broadcast.
Hi, I'm Kurt Snook on the choral tradition. Today,
welcome to University Concert. I'm Karen Impala.
Bringing the cultural richness of our state to your radio, Iowa Public Radio Classical.
Every production I see, something very special happens. because you don't do a piece like this unless you're passionate and committed and excited and eager about it. And it's also an opportunity for opera companies to engage their community in a dialogue about art, life, politics, issues that are relevant to our time, because this is an opera of our time that has all of that connection. And it gives them a doorway to connect with the community in a way that they aren't able to normally, say for The Marriage of Figaro or for Semele or for La Traviata or Otello or, you know, Madame Butterfly. It gives them a doorway to connect to the community and embrace the community in a dialogue about the arts and about social injustice and what that means. And then it opens a door to discussing The Marriage of Figaro is really about social injustice, and so is La Traviata, and so is Madama Butterfly, and that these are universal, timeless stories that have drawn audiences in because of those issues. But so many memorable productions, and I'm always so deeply moved and thrilled when a company embraces it. I'm thrilled that Des Moines is embracing it and has a great cast and a new production, especially for their theater, and I know that it's going to be really powerful and beautiful and deeply moving. And I know you've already got a lot of activities going. I know Sister Helen Prejean was just there. You have dialogues going on with the community, public forums, concerts. You know, it's really, really remarkable. I find that terribly, terribly moving.
Composer Jake Hagee complimenting the Des Moines Metro Opera for initiating conversations about major social issues presented in his opera Dead Man Walking. As part of the DMMO Staging Connections, Jake Hagee will be in Iowa on June 28th for a free afternoon Q&A session at the Des Moines Temple for the Performing Arts, and that evening at the DMMO's opening night performance of his opera, Dead Man Walking. Welcome back. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jacqueline Hallblom. Jake shares about his Midwestern roots.
I grew up, you know, in the Midwest, but I had family in the East Coast, so I spent a lot of time on the East Coast, and then we moved to the West Coast, so I sort of have the whole country in my background.
Jake continues talking about his career.
I finished high school in Northern California, and then I went to college at the American College in Paris for 2 years, and then transferred to UCLA. I moved to Los Angeles, went there for undergrad and graduate work, and then moved to San Francisco in 1993.
So in addition to being a composer, you're also a pianist?
Yes, I started off, that was my goal, was to be a concert pianist, although I loved musical theater. Yeah, I was a classical pianist who grew up loving, movie musicals and wanted to do that. I didn't know anything about opera. Thought it was really dumb. I still do.
Well, legend has it that you were working for the PR department of the San Francisco Opera, and it's kind of interesting how this all evolves. So tell us how you go from the PR department to being an opera composer.
Yes, it's not your usual career trajectory, is it? I was living in Los Angeles. That's where I did my undergraduate and graduate work. I was a double major as a composer and pianist as an undergrad, and then I entered as a piano major for my master's, and I switched to composition. I left that program when I injured my right hand. It was a slow-growing injury called a focal dystonia, which was a problem where my fingers would curl up in my right hand. It's not uncommon injury for musicians as well as people who do sign language, play the guitar, you know, anyone who uses and stresses their hand. Luckily, mine was not neurological, and I was able to re-educate my hand. But during the period when I was doing that, I had to find a way to sustain myself. And it was about a 5-year really dark period because I couldn't play the piano anymore. And that's how I had primarily identified myself as a musician from about the age of 7 or 8. So it was very distressing at 28 years old not to be able to do that anymore, and I didn't compose for 5 years either. What I found that I could do is I could write about music really well from the inside as a performer, as someone who had been a collaborative musician and had degrees in music. And so I worked for the UCLA Center for the Arts, and then when I moved to Northern California, I worked at Cal Performances at UC Berkeley in their PR marketing department as the writer for the entire company. And then a job opened at San Francisco Opera. And I was invited to join the staff there and be the writer for the company. And my job was to get to know the singers, the conductors, the orchestra, the chorus, every department, the administration, props, costumes, scenery, and write about them and communicate all of this information to the press and get stories and play stories. And, you know, you couldn't have imagined a better apprenticeship for someone who is an aspiring opera composer, except I didn't know I was an aspiring opera composer. When I got there, my hand had come back, so I was playing the piano again. And I met and talked with some of the greatest singers on the planet, who also happened to be some of the greatest people on the planet, including Friederike von Stade, Renee Fleming, Thomas Hampson, Sylvia McNair, Jennifer Larmour, Bryn Terfel. And in taking them around to interviews, we would, you know, share life stories and things. And they would ask what I did besides being the PR guy at the opera. And I said, well, in another life, I was a composer. And invariably, they said, well, I'd love to see something that you wrote sometime. And I always thought they were being nice. And out of the blue, it was Friederike von Stade who really sort of said she'd really love to see something. And so as a surprise, because she inspired me so much, I wrote 3 folk song settings. And I gave them to her as an opening night gift of The Dangerous Liaisons. She was doing the world premiere of Conrad Susa and Philip Littell's opera, The Dangerous Liaisons. And I gave them to her that night, and she was really delighted, and she came in early the next performance so that we could read through them. And I thought, well, this is as good as this is ever going to get. Here's a dream come true. I'm playing for Friederike von Stade things that I wrote. And she leaned over and she said, you know, Jake, these are really good. Would you like to give a concert together sometime? And I said, sure, I think I can make space in my calendar to play a concert with you. And so, true to her word, she invited me to play for her, and we actually traveled together. I started writing a lot for her, and she told everyone she knew about this composer that she knew in San Francisco. And suddenly I was getting requests from really amazing singers from all over the world who were traveling with my music. I won a competition through G. Shermer, their art song competition. And then one day, out of the blue, the general director at that time, Lotfi Mansouri, pulled me aside. I thought he wanted me to write another press release or speech or something like that, because I had my day job, of course. And he said, well, you're getting these songs performed all over the world. I think you might be a theater composer. Singers love your work. Audiences respond to it. He goes, we have a spot in the 2000-2001 season for a new opera, and I'm looking for a discovery. And so I'd like to send you to New York to meet with Terrence McNally. I've been trying to get him to write a libretto and see if you guys might come up with an opera for our main stage season in 2000. Well, my first response was, who are you talking to? But I went to New York and I met with Terrence McNally, and initially Lotfi had wanted us to think about writing a comedy, you know, something light and bubbly and frothy and fun for the millennium. And you should have seen Lotfi's face when Terrence and I came back to him and suggested Dead Man Walking. But that was our suggestion, and that's where it started. And Lotfi created a composer in residence position for me so that I could transition out of my other job but still be employed. It was just a remarkable, like Cinderella type story, where all of my dreams suddenly came true because this ingenious, innovative impresario who was always on the lookout for talent gave me an opportunity like that. And so it became the road to creating the opera Dead Man Walking.
Terrence McNally has a huge following on his own. I mean, he's so great. And how did you two decide then, or come to the decision to do this Dead Man Walking?
Well, Terrence was not interested in a comic opera, which is what Lotfi had asked us about for San Francisco. If he was going to do an opera, he wanted to do a big American drama that had real resonance and felt very relevant of our time, but also felt timeless and also had sort of international impact. That's what really wonderful opera stories have, is they feel timeless and resonant throughout history because the characters feel sort of mythological stature. And that the issues that are at stake are things that people will deal with over and over because they're very human issues. And he said he was walking down the street one day and just suddenly Dead Man Walking popped into his head, and he got very excited about it. And he came to San Francisco to tell me a list of ideas that he had, but he said there was only one that he really wanted to do. He had 10 ideas that he'd written down. There was only one he really wanted to do, and he hoped that it would be the same one I wanted to do, because if it wasn't, it was really the only thing he was interested in, and maybe we weren't meant to work together. So he set to reading his list, and the first thing he said was Dead Man Walking, and I responded instantly. Every hair on my head went up, and I got chills. I got that musical rush. I just felt like something important had happened, and it just was a brilliant idea, because it was a great American drama, and yet it's a universal drama about something that people have to deal with in every society throughout history and into the future. And so that's when I told him, you can stop reading right there. I know that's the right subject. And he asked if he could please continue reading the list. And he did, but my mind had already been set on Dead Man Walking because, again, it felt very American but universal, very much of our time and yet timeless. The people in it, their emotional journeys and the conflicts within it were so large, it made sense that it would fill an opera house, the emotional content. I could imagine solos, ensembles, choruses. It felt like it had the trajectory. It felt like it had the resonance and the excitement. It also, at that time, had great name recognition because the book and the movie had been out only recently, and the movie had won an Academy Award for Susan Sarandon. And it was controversial, which I also liked. And the good thing about that subject, too, was it wasn't people saying, well, what is that? It was people saying, why are you going to do that, and how are you going to do that? And that's a great place to start, because you're not explaining what the piece is. You're talking about, really, the elements of how are you going to translate that onto the stage so that it feels pertinent and immediate and accessible. And so that's really how it came about. It was Terrence McNally's brilliant idea. And Sister Helen Prejean jumped on board right away. She called me out of the blue. I picked up the phone and she said, I'd like to speak to Jake Hagee. And I said, this is Jake. She goes, Jake, this is Sister Helen Prejean. And I just heard that the San Francisco Opera wants to make an opera out of Dead Man Walking. You know what I said, Jake? And I said, no. I hope you said yes. She said, I said, of course we're going to make an opera out of Dead Man Walking. But Jake, I don't know boo-scat about opera, so you're going to have to educate me. And she said, now you don't write this atonal stuff, right? We're going to have a tune we can hum. We're going to have some music we can hang on to. And I assured her that I was a very lyrical composer, and my goal was lyricism that the audience would embrace, that would enhance and enliven the characters and their journeys and the story. And we got along very well right from the start, and she was a great friend to the project. She never wanted to interfere. All she asked at the beginning was that it remain a story of redemption, and we said, absolutely, you know, our goal is to remain true to the story that you told. She knew that things would have to change, that characters would have to disappear or be combined or be invented, but that the goal was a story of redemption and transformation, and that's what we tried to accomplish.
Did you expect the debate it has generated over the death penalty?
What I hoped for is that if we did our job right, it would bring people into the story so that they had a chance to reflect and meditate on the different issues that the opera puts forth and that Sister Helen's journey and her story puts forth. We are not in a world that encourages reflection very much. Some people still go to religious places of worship or reflection or meditation, but most people don't stop to think unless they're at the movies or if they happen to be in the theater. And the thing about opera is it demands your attention and your participation. You have people living out a human drama on the stage in three dimensions and pouring their hearts out through music and words. And so it sort of demands your participation and your interaction. And with this opera, it demands that you take time to reflect on something that most people only consider in the abstract. And I was very guilty of that, too. I was a little bit ambivalent about the death penalty when I started writing. I thought about it in the abstract. You know, yeah, it makes sense to me. You know, this person kills this person or all these people, that they get the ultimate punishment. And I think most people don't stop and reflect on the real human implications and the ripple effect of that situation until they see the opera and they see a terrible crime committed and they're brought into the dialogue about what he did and how it's impacted other people. And then they're brought into the dialogue about his own family and other people involved, including prison guards and wardens and other people involved with an execution and how it implicates every single one of us. And the story itself, we wanted to draw people into the dialogue, not tell them how to feel. The opera doesn't preach at you or tell you how you should feel or tell you you're wrong for not believing this or this or that. What it does, it just tells you the story and lets you make up your own mind about those things. But I think that's part of the power of the opera too, is that it just brings people into the story so that they can reflect and see how that resonates in their heart. I think people are surprised when they go to the opera because there's moments of great humor as well in the story, surprisingly. But that's a very real human situation too. When things get too intense or too dark, we make jokes to get through it. And that's another brilliant part of Terrence McNally's libretto. But really, just to open a discussion and a dialogue.
Composer and pianist Jake Hagee. Jake Hagee will be in Iowa on June 28th for an afternoon event at the Des Moines Temple for the Performing Arts and for the Des Moines Metro Opera's opening night performance of his opera Dead Man Walking at the Blank Performing Arts Center in Indianola. The opera Dead Man Walking does contain a parental advisory and is not recommended for anyone under age 18. To find out more details about the Des Moines Metro Opera's upcoming festival season and other concerts and events, please go to their website at desmoinesmetroopera.org. If you enjoy hearing about the performing arts scene on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase and the role Iowa Public Radio plays in presenting the arts in Iowa, please make your pledge of support today at iowapublicradio.org, and thanks. Today's Iowa Arts Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks for this production goes to Sister Helen Prejean, Michael Gilbertson, Daniel Kleinkonecht, Stephanie Wager, Jason Weinberger, and Jake Hagee. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner. Thanks for the show also goes to IPR's Phil Moss and IPR's John Pemble and music director Al Scherz, along with IPR's Eric Jordan, Jason Burns, Garrett Van Leeuwen, and Cooper Holmeyer. Program research was provided by Nick Carlo and Scott Bosco. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. Thanks for joining us. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.